So I can remember the first time I was here. I came with Bruce Van Wyk and his wife, Marge, back in 1960, I guess it was 1964. Bruce is from Sully, Iowa. How about that? The metropolis of Sully, Iowa. When Bruce left, the population split. And but I remember coming out here as a, I'd been contacted by the NAS up in Canada, and I came out here. Bruce wanted to talk to Leroy Imes. Leroy is one of our international leaders, and wanted to talk to Leroy about coming on the staff of the Navigators. And I went with Bruce for that little interview. At that time, Leroy was the U.S. director, and a very important function in the Navigators. And so Bruce was talking to Leroy about coming on the staff, and they got that all. And I was just a young Christian; I was only 2 years old in the Lord, but I was so impressed by the place, and so zealous and impetuous and everything else that when Bruce had finished talking to Leroy, I turned to Leroy and I said, "Well, now Leroy, my wife and I are thinking of joining the staff of the Navigators and so on and so forth." And of course, I didn't know anything about the Navigators at that point, other than I was impressed. And he kind of casually turned to me and said, "Well, I think the best thing for you would be to go home and play church." And it was a very derogatory statement, and he doesn't even recall having made it. But I remember when I left his office that I thought, well, that cotton picker, one day I'll be on the staff of the Navigator. and of course, it took many years. It didn't take one day. And that was not a very healthy goal, as I look back on it, unless God is leading you in that particular direction. But welcome to Glen Eyrie. We're really thankful you're here, not from a financial standpoint, really. We run the conference center here because we feel that that's what God would have us to do in order to carry out and to promote our ministry in the field, and you are considered the field. Ron Shimkus and Larry and so on, our field staff men, and we only run this conference center as a to facilitate their ministry. If we wanted to be in the conference center business, we would have motel units here and we'd have accommodations for about 1,000 people, and we'd do it right if we wanted to be in the conference business. But we're not in the conference business. We're in the business of meeting the needs of people and ministering to them, and particularly keeping it in some kind of a manageable form. We have plenty of acreage here, and we could easily increase the facility size, but we have knowingly and willfully decided to keep it at about a maximum in terms of couples for the summer of 110 couples. We can accommodate about 220 people, or 110 couples. And now when students come, I would imagine we could get about 400 or 500 in here if we wanted a dormitory, every room, and pack them in like sardines. But that is not our purpose. And God has given us this place to use in terms of meeting needs in smaller groups and a little more intensely. Let's see, my job in the Navigators, in case you don't know what a deputy does, a deputy does everything that the director does not want to do. And I have basically the responsibility to handle all of support ministries of the Navigators, if you want to use that term. For instance, Glen Eyrie is one of my responsibilities, the conference center. Nav Press, our publishing, is one of my responsibilities. The fundraising, the processing of gift income, the computer, and all of that comes under my responsibility. We do have a fantastic staff out here. You're going to meet, in fact, the guy you're going to meet tomorrow, Jerry Bridges, who wrote the book, lives the book, by the way. Jerry and I worked together for 4 years. And believe me, what he writes, he lives, right down to the nitty-gritty and to the detail, and you are going to be blessed tremendously by his ministry in your life. But all of that responsibility ultimately comes onto my desk, and then I report to Jack Mahal, who is the U.S. director. We have all kinds of opportunities for you to serve when you get out of the college scene. And if you're interested in that, in terms of finding out about those opportunities, you can go over to the main office building, the new office building, and ask for the personnel director, tell them I sent you, and pick up an application form, and just send that in with some preliminary information. If you're graduating this fall and you're interested, or this spring, and you're interested in some kind of tying into a Christian organization in a support manner, we offer all kinds of opportunities out here. Everything from art, graphics, writing, editorial, computer, to sweeping the floors. You name it, we've got it. And we always are in the need of people who are dedicated to serve in that area. So if you're interested along those lines, or somewhere down the line if you're interested, just drop me a note. And we'll get a little preliminary thing going on you and investigate whether that's what God would have you to do. Ron asked me to share my testimony and then a little bit of ministry from the Word. I was born and raised in Canada, in the area of Toronto, Ontario, which is north of Buffalo, about 90 miles, or right across the lake from Cleveland. Okay, so that'll give you a little geography. It's in the snow belt, and our winters there were really, truly winters. In fact, we were just home over Christmas, and all of the outdoor, I learned to play hockey on an outdoor pond, and then they built boards around it, and they do that on every public school grounds in the city. The city come out, they construct the boards and put nets up, and then about around the middle of December, they flood that, and you can play clean through till about March. Now, the problem is that you play with every kid on the neighborhood at the same time in about six different games. And so I don't know whether you've ever seen a game of hockey, and you know that it's violent enough if you've only got one puck, but can you imagine having about six games going on and everybody just flying by? And pretty soon you learn to be a pretty good hockey player, or you quit the sport. I don't know whether you're familiar with this kid, Wayne Gretzky. But he is the superstar of superstars in hockey right now. He's 20 years old and just accomplished what most people thought was the impossible feat of scoring 50 goals in 39 games, and that's about half the season. Now the record, the previous record, was 50 goals in 50 games. So you can tell how far ahead of the whole thing. I know how he learned to play hockey. He grew up in the West. And similar to our climate, every little boy played hockey. Like kids down here carry a basketball, we carried a hockey stick. Summer, fall, winter, spring. It was hockey, whether you played it out on the street or up. And you learned to be pretty good at it, or you quit playing the sport. I had no spiritual upbringing whatsoever. No spiritual orientation whatsoever. I can only recall on one occasion my mother taking us to church, and we never went back for whatever reason. I can remember no sane conversations regarding the personhood of Jesus Christ or God in our house whatsoever. We were very familiar with the names, but never in a spiritual sense. I grew up in a home where there was a lot of the expression of emotions was never controlled, and you would express yourself verbally as violently as you could to make your point, and if that didn't work, you took to physical resources to accomplish your purpose in that communication. And that was communicated through the entire family. I can remember one supper sitting at the table, and my mother and father had been going at it for about a half hour or so, and the thing was really heating up, and the next thing I know, a butter plate just flew and hit the wall and slithered down the wall. I can remember at other times where physical violence was used between my older brother and my dad to resolve some conflicts, and of course it never did resolve conflicts, but that was the kind of home I grew up in. And so you became A person, you had to survive. And the way you survive in that kind of a family is that you protect yourself and you become as strong as you possibly can, both verbally and physically, and that's what I did. I had no restraints on my life whatsoever. I began to play hockey when I was 10 years old. By the time I was 14, I was being paid for the sport. By the time I was about 17 or 18, I was getting a good wage for the sport. Of course, as an amateur, you never were paid above the table. It was always below the table because amateurs were not supposed to be paid for it. But I learned that hockey could bring me the things that I thought were important in life. And one of the things that was important to me was to have money. The other thing was to have some kind of fame and glory. And I don't know whether you've studied the game, but there are really two kinds of hockey players. There are those guys that are like the Wayne Gretzky's. They're the technicians of the game. They're the skillful players. They have developed the finesse of the game in terms of scoring or assisting, setting up the play so that somebody else can score. And then there are some other guys on the teams that it's their job to go around and try and dismember those guys that they're technically proficient. And I, at about the age of 14, I realized that being the size I was, probably when I was 14 or 15, I weighed maybe 10 pounds more than I do right now, probably about 180, somewhere in there, 185 pounds. And I was big for my age, and built low to the ground, which is very helpful. It's like running into a fire plug on the hockey ice. And I learned to utilize all of that leverage that I had. Plus, I was brutal. I thought nothing of dropping my sticks and gloves and just, you know, banging some guy in the head. And, of course, in those days, we never played with helmets. We kind of feel that helmets were an invention for some of the weaker players. Now almost everybody wears a helmet. But back in those days, you didn't. And, of course, if you were going to get... Those fights are real. They are not staged for the entertainment of the fans. Those are real emotions being expressed. And I learned that by expressing my emotions in that way and by taking some guy to task right out in the middle of the ice, that you could bring 10,000 people out of their chairs and screaming. And that's what we used to, as amateurs, we, you know, 18, 19 years old, we'd play in arenas where, I mean, hockey is a passion in Canada, and you'd have, 10, 12,000. We played Sunday afternoons in Toronto Maple Leaf Gardens as amateurs, and would pack the place out with about 15 to 16,000 people. And boy, when you learned that you could control a crowd by the way that you played, that's a heady experience. And I got into that whole scene. Now, I also got into alcohol, and I was well on my way by the time I was 21 to carrying on alcoholism into the second generation of our family. I started when I was 14 and didn't get control of it until a number of years later, and I'm sure if drugs had been on the scene and popular back then, that I would have been into the drug scene, but they were just not as popular and as available as they are today. But I would have been into it. Not for any particular reason other than to fill the void in my life. See, I had everything that a young guy could possibly want. I had a very promising career in professional sports. I had money. I had popularity, or so I thought. And just a number of other things that many people feel are very important. But I got into these other things because there was a tremendous void in my life, and I never knew what it was. No one ever shared the gospel with me in the first 22 years of my life, as far as I know. Now, somebody might have attempted to, and I maybe didn't listen or whatever. But in my recollection, in the first 22 years of my life, I never heard the gospel. Now, Canada is not that, you know, pagan. And you would think that in 22 years of living, you would have at least heard somebody talk about... I did have one guy witness to me, a Jehovah's Witness. And he was very faithful, boy. He really laid it on his school chum. Told him if he ever talked to me about it again, I'd punch him out. And that was the end of the religious orientation. That's the only guy I can ever remember who shared anything spiritual with me. I signed a professional contract. See, my whole life was geared toward being a professional hockey player. On Saturday nights, we were just up there 2 weeks ago. On Saturday nights, in the eastern part of Canada. Everybody gathers around the tube to watch hockey night in Canada. Now, back in those days, there were only six professional teams at the world-class level. The Russians hadn't even arrived into hockey at that point. There were only six world-class professional teams. One of them was the Toronto Maple Leafs. And on Saturday nights, the Toronto Maple Leafs always played a visiting team. They would come in and play. And I dreamed and had a passion that my dad and my mom could watch me play hockey on Saturday night in Canada. And I played for the Toronto Maple Leaf farm system. All the teams there are sponsored outside of the school system, by the way. And they're sponsored by professional teams. Because it's just like a baseball farm team, only it starts much earlier, and they want you to progress to the place where they can draft you and you become eligible to play for the professional team. Now, my ambition was to play for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And when I signed my professional, and I played all the way through my amateur ranks at 21, signed my professional contract, and the next day they sold my contract to the Detroit Red Wings. Now, I don't know whether you've ever visited Toronto, Ontario, Canada, but when you compare that to Detroit, Michigan, the USA, I mean, you have to understand that being a Canadian, I had some deep feelings about Detroit and going to play hockey in that city was just anathema to me at that point. And I was very bitterly disappointed and, in fact, was ready to quit, but my dad talked me into going out. And by the way, back in those days, that was when Detroit Red Wings were a powerhouse. They were perennial winners of the national title. And the guy who just retired 2 years ago, Gordie Howe, the grandfather hockey player, you know, he was, 49 or 50 when he retired, played with his two sons in the professional league. At that time, he was in his prime playing for the Detroit Red Wings, and he was only one of about six superstars on the same team. So you can imagine what I felt like. First of all, I felt my chances were better in the Toronto system because they didn't have as strong a team. But then to get traded to Detroit, who had the top team in the league, and the chances of making that were just so minimal. And I went out and tried out with them, and they farmed me out to one of their farm teams in Milwaukee in the International Hockey League, and I played my first year of professional hockey. And at the end of that season, I returned to my home in Toronto. And I got back in with the same crowd. Everything I had made that year in hockey, and it was good money, everything I had made, I had spent. I had blown. We had a party from October to April. And in fact, I had to borrow money to drive the 500 miles from Milwaukee to Toronto to get home, just to spend the summer. And I began to live with my parents and run around with the same crowd and so on. And within a matter of weeks, I got into trouble with the police and was arrested on my second felony count within a year's period. And I realized as I sat in jail that I was in serious trouble. And this was not the first time I'd had a scrape with the law. But I was, you know, this was really very, very serious. So as I sat there in jail, I thought, now what in the world am I going to do? I'll call my dad. You know, it's interesting how your thoughts always go to your parents when you're in trouble. My dad just retired, I guess it's 5 years now that he's retired, but he worked 42 years for the same company as a blue-collar worker. He worked 15 years on shift work with a two-week vacation every year. You know what shift work is? You work the day shift, then the next week you go on to the afternoon shift, and then the next week the graveyard shift from midnight to 8 in the morning. He worked 15 years with two-week vacations on that kind of a schedule. And then he got a big promotion. He went into the office as a clerk and worked the next almost 30 years of his life and never got beyond that job. Now, you could best describe my dad as a hard-working blue-collar worker. And as I sat in jail that night, I thought, boy, if I call Dad, he's just going to tell him to throw the key away because he was fed up with my lifestyle. And he had contempt that I was blowing some good opportunities with the way I was living. So I remembered that my mother had told me my brother-in-law and sister had become religious while I was away playing hockey that year. In fact, she said it was far worse than that, that they had become Baptists. And I don't know what she had against the Baptists, but apparently there was something in her background that it really bothered her. But as I sat in jail, I did know some things, or at least I thought I did, about religious people. And one of the things I thought was that they were responsible to visit widows and orphans and people in jail. And so I decided I was going to test my brother-in-law's and sister's newfound faith and see whether they really were going to live according to this faith and if they could get me out of the jam that I was in. So I called him. It was late on a Saturday night. I told him the predicament I was in. I used the one phone call I had, told him that they would not take American Express or MasterCharge, nor a check, but they wanted cash, or if he didn't have cash, could he bring the deed down, the property deed, to his house, and they would hold that in lieu of my appearance in court. And he said, no way am I going to bring the property deed for my house. I will try to raise the cash from my medical associates, but you'll have to just cool your heels until I do that, and I'll be down to get you when I can. So he came down several hours later and bailed me out. And you can imagine, you'll have to kind of visually imagine the conversation that my brother-in-law, about 5 years older than I am, is going to have with me as he drives me home. I mean, he's got this newfound spirituality, and he's getting his life in order, and here he's got the wayward black sheep of the family that he's going to get straightened out. And so he started to lay some heavies on me. He said, Bob, you know, you need to get your head on straight and all of that. And I said, well, Ray, I really appreciate your concern for my life, and I recognize that I have those needs. What do you suggest? He said, well, I think you ought to go to church with us, and you ought to come to church with us Sunday morning. I said, well, Ray, you know my lifestyle. And my problem is, on Sunday mornings, I'm not feeling too well. In fact, maybe sometimes I'm feeling too good to be in church. And I said, that just doesn't fit in. He said, that's okay. This church has it figured out. And for guys just like you, they have a Sunday evening service. Now, I knew that much about church. Zip. And I honestly believe that they had a service on Sunday night in this church for guys who were really basically drunks. See, in those days, the blue laws were still in existence. That meant that the bars closed Saturday night at midnight and didn't open until noon on Monday. So usually you were sober sometime around Sunday night when you ran out of your supply. And so I really thought that this church had figured out something. And I thought, gee, if they've gone to all that trouble, somebody should go and listen. So I got conned into going to church for the first time in my life. And for the next 8 Sunday nights in a row, I listened to the gospel. And I can remember vividly the first night when I left that auditorium. I was just drenched with perspiration and the conviction that was upon me. I got out to my car, and I could hardly light a cigarette. My hands were trembling. And I couldn't figure out what in the world was going on. And I went back the next Sunday night, and I had the same experience. I remember one of the illustrations he used. This was a downtown church, and they still run the trolley cars in Toronto with the little pole up the back and that whole thing. Big, heavy dudes. And you could hear them rumble by the church about every 10 or 15 minutes. And one of the illustrations the pastor used was, now what would happen to you if you walked out that door and while you were crossing the street, you got zapped by one of those trolley cars. Where would you end up? Boy, when I went out that night, I looked both ways. I tell you, I got to the car, and my hands were just... there was no way. I was under tremendous conviction. But nobody ever told me what to do about it. So finally, after 2 months, 8 weeks of attending this... and you know what it's like in the Baptist church. By the way, I'm ordained in the Baptist church, and you know what it's like there. I mean, every Sunday night, it's the gospel and 12 choruses of Just As I Am. So I heard the message. I knew by the end of that time what was required to become a Christian. But I think I knew even more than that. And for some reason, God didn't allow me to make an early initial commitment. Because by the time I made my commitment and I was ready to receive Jesus Christ, I understood fully that Jesus wanted to be not only the Savior, not only to be the one to redeem me and to put my life back on the road, but he wanted to be the Lord of my life. And I have never wrestled with the whole issue of whether Jesus Christ is going to be the Lord of my life or not. The night that I went down the aisle and made that decision for Christ, it was very clear that Jesus was both Savior and Lord, and that it just demanded absolute obedience. So I've never really struggled with that. What I've struggled with is the practicality of obedience. That is, am I willing to be obedient? Am I willing, every time I come up against one of those obstacles, to decide and do what Jesus wants me to do? That was in April of 1962. The following year, I met the Navigators. I met them on a fishing trip. We had organized, or a couple of guys in the church had organized a fishing trip, and my brother-in-law and I were avid fishermen. I mean, the kind of guys who go and you get up before light and you don't come back out of the boat until the mosquitoes have driven you out at night. And we would drive hours up into northern Ontario and then take boats with Indian guides and go further back. So you can imagine the kind of fishermen. Well, we got a little schedule from one of the guys who was organizing the trip, and it was fishing time, you know, from 7:30 till 10:30 in the morning. And then there was an hour break for spiritual refreshment. And then I had a navigator beside it. I didn't know what a navigator was. I had no idea. In fact, my brother-in-law and I were so ticked off that we were not going to go on the trip because it had been organized around this spiritual content. And we weren't going for spiritual content. We were going to fish. And I can remember that navigator when he came, and we met down by the waterfront, and we had a couple of benches and a few chairs. And he was facing us, but the lake was behind us, and we're all sitting there basically with our fishing poles and tackle boxes, kind of, you know. And he very wisely gave a little 5-minute devotion and jumped in the boats with us and went fishing. And then later on that weekend, the first attraction I had to the Navigators were there was a non-Christian guy on the trip and myself as a very new babe in Christ. And I wandered over to a picnic table, and there was this navigator and, as I realize it now, his disciple, were witnessing to this non-Christian. And I'd been struggling for a year in my life on how to share my newfound faith with my friends. Now, the way I did it was that I met them where we usually met, in the bar. And I would begin to share with my buddies on how Christ had really changed my life. And by midnight, the bartender would throw us all out stone drunk. See, I still had an alcoholic problem. And I couldn't understand why I was, why they wouldn't realize that my life had changed. And Jesus had changed my life and could do the same for them. Well, they couldn't see it. So there was no way they were going to buy the message. I watched these two guys witness to this non-Christian using the bridge illustration. And I came unglued. I thought, now that really helps to communicate what the gospel is all about. And I want to get involved in whatever they're doing. The non-Christian guy was not interested in the least bit, and eventually he got up and wandered away, and I kind of stood there and looked at that illustration, wanting to pick it up and get a hold of it so that I could take it home, memorize those verses, and I'd be able to share with my buddies. And there was kind of a long, awkward pause, and of course these two navigator guys were very perceptive. They knew exactly what was going on in my heart and so on. And finally I said, hey, could I have that? And they said, oh, sure, why don't you take that? Well, and when I got home the following weekend, the next Monday, one of the guys called me and he said, Bob, it's Paul calling and how you doing and so on, all that stuff. We'd like to invite you to a Bible study. And I thought, oh, that is fantastic. I said, boy, I'd just be delighted to join your Bible study. What time does it meet? He said, 6 o'clock on Saturday. And I said, man, that's fantastic. That'll work into my schedule fine. I'll be there at 6. Should I have come eating dinner or not? I said, no, Bob, you don't understand. It's 6 in the morning is when we meet. And that was my introduction to the Navigators. In fact, then I really got promoted. I got invited to a prayer meeting that lasted for 1 year that met at 6 o'clock every morning. And it only missed one morning in that entire year. Now, that was the foundation of my Christian life. I am in the ministry today because those men, I didn't make every one of those prayer meetings. But there was a core and a nucleus of men. In fact, this fellow Paul, he just called me a few weeks ago. He's on our staff up in Canada. and I'd been praying about a decision I need to make. And Paul called me and he said, Bob, I just want you to know that he actually wrote me, I'm sorry, he didn't call me. He wrote me and said, I want you to know that we're praying with you on this decision, and it caused me to recall how long I've been praying for you. And I've been praying for you regularly, daily, since we met. And my family has prayed for your family at least once a month for all those years. And I thought, I know why God blesses my life. Not because of me, but because of that tremendous prayer support that he and many others like him. And then I thought about building into a person's life. How do you really build into a person's life? Well, it's not all the little packages, and it's not all the little know-how. That's part of it, and an important part. But the primary principle of imparting spiritual life is prayer. Prayer. That's how you build into another person's life. See, because you don't need to be in physical contact to continue a ministry in a person's life. You just need to pray for them. Well, that was my introduction to the Navigators. I got involved. They had a little, you know how they trained us in witnessing in those days, evangelism? We didn't have the concept of going to a pool of manpower or women power like a university campus. That was in the days when those things were just becoming formulated in thinking. And these were just a bunch of people who got together and tried to have some kind of a ministry. So they said, look, we go over on Sunday afternoons to the park and we share Christ with people who will listen. Would you like to go? We'll train you in it. I said, man, that's fantastic. Yeah, you bet. I'd love to learn how to share my faith effectively. So I went with Paul this first trip. And I can remember. We went to the church. We got a bunch of people together. We prayed and then we all split up and went out. And we went to this guy who was sitting on a park bench. And he looked like I used to look like after a hard night. And he'd had a hard night, about 45, 50 years old. And Paul just wheeled up alongside him and sat down. He said, sir, we're out sharing Jesus Christ with people, and I'd like to talk to you about spiritual things. Are you interested in spiritual things? The guy said, no. And I thought, well, come on, Paul, let's go down there. And Paul said, well, that's very interesting. We don't run into too many people that aren't interested in spiritual things. Could you tell me why? And the guy took the next 45 minutes to tell us why he wasn't involved. And, of course, Paul then beautifully moved into the guy. I thought that was the most fantastic experience. And, man, I was turned on to getting more training in evangelism. I went back the next Sunday, but I had graduated. I was no longer the trainee. I now became a trainor and took a brand new person out. I had 1 week of evangelism training. Things were a little different in my day than they are in your day. We didn't know any better. And so I had to take a guy out and go out on evangelism. Man, that was hard stuff. Then Sunday afternoons in the winter, of course, winters are winter up there, like they are back in Iowa. And Sunday afternoons what we'd do is we'd go to these big indoor malls, which only had about two or three entrances. And people, the stores were all closed, but people would come to window shop and, you know, get in out of the cold and so on. And then we would get on those doors and we could witness to every person that came in or out of that building. And that's what we used to do until we got run off by the security police or whatever for sharing our faith. And that's how we learned how to do evangelism. That was my original contact with the Navs. And then in 1966, the Navigators asked us to move to Madison, Wisconsin, and to get some more training to be there for a year and then to go back to Canada and begin to work with university students in Canada, in eastern Canada, where we didn't have any ministry with students at all. So we were very excited about that. We moved in September of 1966, and we have not yet got to go back. We are slow learners, and we're still in the process of training, I suppose. And God has not given us the inclination in our hearts at this point to go back, although the opportunity, of course, is there any time that we're ready to respond to that. We Nancy and I, look on the Navigators as our family. I mean, we are so grateful to God for the family of the Navigators. And it's not that they're not without fault. This is not a perfect organization, if you haven't discovered that already. And if you have, you ought not to be with it. because we're not all perfect, are we? And we don't want to ruin a perfect organization, so we all need to leave, and then maybe it'll be okay. But the NAVs are really a family to us. They have taught us many things. We're indebted to them for the growth and the help that they've been in our marriage. And I don't think Nancy and I would have made it in our marriage without the help that the Navigators gave us. We were 5 years into our marriage before anybody ever gave us a book on marriage. And it was the Navigators who began to help us in that whole area. We had never read the pastor that married us in Canada. I mean, it was a liberal pastor who had no idea that you were supposed to counsel with people and give them a little help before they got started in their marriage. We had no orientation toward that whatsoever. And so Nancy and I look at the NAVs with very fond hearts because of the tremendous ministry that they've had and the opportunity that they've given us to minister to people all over the world. And, you know, you don't need to travel far to minister to people all over the world. Ron, it's interesting. I have an old fundraising book that I developed back in the days of Wisconsin. And I was just going through it last night. And guys like Bill Buzzard and so on who lived in our home who are now ministering all over the world. And to think that God gave us the privilege to have some input into their lives. I mean, that is a thrill. That's what the Navigators are all about, by the way. It's winning and training and sending people all over the world. Okay, well, why don't you just stand up and greet the person behind you, because I see that last night's travel is catching up. Okay. Take your Bibles and turn to page 1152 or 1 Peter chapter 2. I want to talk just for a few minutes. We won't keep you too long. Oh, by the way, this is a little parenthetical. Have you had anybody from the staff, the Glen Erie staff, talk to you yet? No. Okay. Well, there are rattlesnakes out here. Okay, but they don't come out in the winter, so you don't need to worry about them. But you do need to worry about hiking. If you decide to hike, and particularly in the afternoon, storms come up from the west, which happens to be over here where the mountain is, and you do not see them coming. And that's one thing that's very, very dangerous, even just not too far from here, you know, just up on these hills around here. And secondly, you can fall on these rocks. This summer we had a fellow, fortunately he was with a party that hiked several miles back up this canyon. And broke his compound fracture of his ankle and actually twisted the foot. I don't know how he did it, so that it was, you know, flopping, and foot that flops is not very good. Now, fortunately, he had there in the party that was hiking, there was a nurse and a doctor, which probably kept him from going into shock and perhaps even being a very critical situation. Nevertheless, it took time for someone to come all the way back down and for us to get the help back up there with a stretcher and to get that person, and he happened to be about 6'3 and 220 pounds, and a very hard hike. Now, we don't want to do that, okay? It's just too much hard work. So please, don't. These rocks, even the gentlest of slopes, can be very, very treacherous. And flatlanders that come out here just fail to recognize the problems, okay? By the way, this is your first trip to Glen Erie? How many is this your first trip to the mountains? Okay, well, there's a few flatlanders here that... will you guys get on that ski tow and you look down that 60 or 70 feet, you'll wonder, why in the world am I here? But don't worry about it. You'll have a fantastic time. Just get short skis, very short skis, and park them out in front of a lodge and just go in and sit by the restaurant. When Shimkus comes buzzing down off the hill, he says, how's it going? Say, well, man, it's just going fantastic. Let me buy you a coffee. And he'll go put his skis on and go back. He'll never know that you never went on the hill at all. That's how most of them do it out here, so don't worry about it. You will have a great time, by the way, that I don't recall in the 5 years we've lived out here ever having the base of snow that we have right now. You have come at a fantastic time. And you're going to get some of the best, this is probably some of the best skiing in the world in Colorado, because you don't get the icy conditions. You get such a light powder because of the low humidity in the air, and you're going to have a fantastic time. But dress warmly, even if you hike or you ski. You can always take it off, but when you're on the top of that lift and that wind is howling and you don't have it on, oh, you don't even have it with you, you're going to get awful cold. And that's the one problem in skiing in January, that it just gets bitterly cold. So take lots of clothing and something for your face to cover your face, because that'll really get cold. That's all free. That wasn't in the message or anything like that. I wish we were going with you. I can't go till next week. I'm just doing what Rod Sargent told me. He said we had to go skiing next week. It was part of the ministry, so I came out here to suffer for Jesus. So. You know, your brother says you got to go do it, you just go do it. Okay, 1 Peter chapter 2. Let me read from verse 2 to 5 out of the New American Standard. Like newborn babes, long for the pure milk of the Word, that by it you may grow in respect to salvation, if you had tasted the kindness of the Lord. And coming to him as to a living stone, rejected by man, but choice and precious in the sight of God, you also as living stones are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Now, I tried to avoid this passage when Ron wrote and asked me to speak on just a few principles of spiritual growth. I have spoke so many times from this passage that it becomes a little bit tiresome. And yet, as I think of all of the passages in the Scriptures that best describe a few key principles of spiritual growth, this probably has to be the classic in my mind. I did review John 15, and we might just flip over there in a little bit and tie some similar thoughts in with the with John 15. But let me give you a couple of principles of spiritual growth. See in verse 5 where it says that you are becoming, or you're being built up as a spiritual house. Now, gang, in case you didn't realize it, that ought to be your goal in life. See, your goal in life ought not to be a navigator, or to be a pastor, or to be a computer science person, or to be a doctor, teacher, lawyer, or whatever. Your first and primary goal in life, if you are a child of the King, is to become all that God wants you to become. And first and primary in that is to become a spiritual house. To become the living place of the living God. And so here we see Peter focusing in with these believers that this is a very important principle. I want you to become a spiritual house. Now, obviously, when an author is trying to communicate under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit an important truth, he's going to tell us how to get there, I would think. And I believe he introduces the subject in verse 2. And he says, look, if you want to become a...